This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. For many, the day after Labor Day marks a fresh start. Summer is unofficially over, the kids are back in school, and political campaigns start in earnest again before the November general election. In North Idaho, voters will help pick a new governor and a new congressional member, in addition to candidates for statewide and legislative offices. They'll also decide two initiatives. One would allow betting on so-called historical horse races. The other would have Idaho expand its Medicaid program to cover tens of thousands of residents who don't have health insurance. We'll hear more about those on an upcoming Inland Journal. In Washington, voters will choose legislators and county elected officials. There are no races for statewide office, but there are four initiatives, and we've invited our Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins to give us some general descriptions about those.
Yes, so 1634, we're just doing these in numerical order, has to do with, and it's interesting, the title of this is Taxation of Groceries, but what this is really about is the soda pop industry stepping into the state, the national soda pop industry, that is, stepping into the state and saying, trying to draw a line and say no to Seattle-style taxes on soda pop. So Seattle passed a tax on sugary drinks. The industry is now saying they don't want this idea to get adopted by other cities and local governments. And so there's an initiative on the ballot that would prevent other cities from adopting a Seattle-style soda pop tax. And again, it's funded by the soda pop industry, but being billed as no more taxes on groceries.
So that's a preemptive strike, because when I saw the first TV spots, I said, I don't know of anybody, certainly in Spokane, that has been talking about that at all.
It's definitely a preemptive strike. It's also not atypical to see industry do this. They see an idea getting some momentum, and they want to sort of stamp it out early. And this is one way to do it. And really what this initiative would say is that no local government entity can impose any new tax or fee on any grocery items. So that is that's why they're calling this a no grocery taxes measure. It prevents those local taxes on any number of items. But again, the focus really here and the reason why this is on the ballot is because of the sugary drink tax.
Okay, let's move to the carbon tax then.
And what you would hear from the carbon tax backers is that it's not a tax, it's a fee. Those are two words that are easy to argue over, and we could go down that road and we won't. But they are saying that what they're trying to do here is establish a fee on carbon emissions from quote-unquote corporate carbon polluters. And here's how this would work. Beginning in January of 2020, there would be a $15 per metric ton fee placed on carbon pollution, again, from larger emitters. And that fee would go up every year by a couple of dollars. It would adjust for inflation. And the goal would be to get the state to a place where it is meeting targets that are already in place in state law to reduce our state's greenhouse gas emissions. So 2035 is a key date where we're trying to reduce our emissions down to historic levels, and then 2050 is another date. But this would be doing something that the governor has really wanted the legislature to do, and the legislature has balked and not been able to pass a carbon pricing mechanism. I should also note that this isn't the first time voters will have the opportunity to vote on a carbon pricing proposal. There was one on the ballot last year that did not pass. This one is structured differently. This one also has the backing of not just environmental groups, but labor organizations, two entities that have a lot of money to put into the campaign to try to get this passed.
And why just the largest emitters?
Largest emitters is actually a bit of a misnomer, because really the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions is you and me. It's our tailpipes from our vehicles. But the focus here is on corporate emissions, those from oil and gas refineries and larger polluters that are, frankly, easier to tax, easier to target. They will very likely pass that cost onto the consumer, but this is structured so that it's not a direct tax on consumers, which would have to happen probably at the gas pump. So really, what the backers are doing here is thinking that they have a perhaps an easy target in those larger polluters, those corporate polluters, and they are banking on the idea that the public is going to be supportive of this idea, especially as we see warmer summers, greater forest fires, and so on and so forth.
So 1639 deals with firearms. Can you tell us more about that one?
What this would do is raise the age of purchase to 21 for semi-automatic rifles. It would also require a more enhanced background check for the purchase of these rifles, similar to the background check that you go through if you buy a pistol, where there's an instant federal check and a local, more extensive background check conducted by local law enforcement. So that would apply to the purchase of these guns. This measure also requires that people who own firearms store them in a safe manner, essentially keep them under lock and key, and that if, say, a child got hold of your gun, the gun went off and someone was hurt or killed, you could be held legally and criminally responsible. So this measure does a lot of things. There's also some things it doesn't do. It doesn't ban so-called assault weapons. It doesn't limit magazine capacity. This is a poll-tested measure that the backers think will pass with a majority of votes in the state, but doesn't go as far as some, including the state attorney general, would go if they had their way.
Let's finish with 940, which is perhaps the most complicated just in terms of its backstory. So can we make this as simple as possible?
This has to do with police use of deadly force, and this initiative changes Washington's threshold for criminally charging a police officer who uses deadly force. Currently, we have what's been described as the highest bar, one of the highest bars in the nation for charging a police officer. You have to find that they acted with malice and in bad faith. This initiative changes that threshold, lowers it, arguably, and also requires new training for police officers around de-escalation, for instance. What happened during the legislative session is that the sponsors of this initiative, the campaign called De-Escalate Washington, actually started working with the law enforcement community on a compromise. And the legislature passed that compromise with the goal of keeping Initiative 940 off the fall ballot. Well, the way they did this created a court challenge, and the Supreme Court has now said that 940 will go on the ballot. The so-called fix that was passed by the legislature will not. And so what I'm expecting is if this initiative passes, and really whether it passes or not, that very likely the deal, the bargain that was struck during this legislative session, that lawmakers will revisit that and very likely repass it next year. Now, keep in mind, if this initiative passes, any changes to it in the first 2 years would require a two-thirds vote of the legislature. That's a requirement here in the state. So it's not easy to change an initiative right after it passes, but there is still, it seems like, this agreement, if you will, between many in law enforcement and these sponsors on language that they think would work and perhaps be even better than what's in the initiative from their perspectives.
Austin Jenkins is the Olympia correspondent for the Northwest News Network. One program note, on September 17th, that's a Monday night, we'll have a special one-hour Inland Journal to talk about the Spokane school bond issue and library bond issue. We'll have proponents of both and take your calls and comments. That's Monday, September 17th at 6 p.m. on KPBX, a special election edition of Inland Journal. Please join us.